President Biden and the Democratic governors he is meeting with today are pledging to find ways to protect access to abortion at the state level. That is where the legislative and legal fights over abortion have been taking place in the weeks since the Supreme Court overturned the constitutional right to an abortion.
The end of Roe v. Wade and some stunning testimony about January 6th from a young White House insider shaped this week in politics. So let's roll in our Friday Politics Roundtable. Margaret Tolov is managing editor at Axios. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Scott. Great to be with you.
Good to have you back. And Scott Wong is senior congressional reporter for NBC. Scott, happy Friday.
Same to you guys. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you. So the president says he now supports tweaking the Senate filibuster rules to make it easier to pass a bill and providing a statutory right to abortion. So, Margaret, this is a midterm year. Democrats may not control the Senate for very long. How significant or not is this?
Well, in Democratic circles, I think it was viewed as significant because the president had always resisted going this far or taking this firmer position before. But practically speaking, what he's actually asking for is for Republicans to agree, enough Republicans to agree with Democrats in order to change the rules. This is not really Biden saying, let's blow up the filibuster and make it go away forever. He's saying, can't we reach some bipartisan agreement to codify Roe v. Wade? The answer to that is no. At least by my last count, Republicans aren't going to be willing to do this. And the two Democrats who've been pivotal, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, also are not going to be willing to do it. And so what does it really mean other than a way to motivate the base? I think now more than ever in the wake of the what is a pattern now of the 6-3 court, others are making the point that if Republicans do take control of the Senate next year, boy, you can see exactly what a Senate with no filibuster would do, and it would be anti-abortion laws codified.
Or you mean if Republicans or Republicans taking over the Senate?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And
okay.
So, yes.
Sorry.
Scott, what would need to change for abortion protections to become law? What do you think?
Well, I mean, you know, in terms of the numbers, you would need to have 60 votes in the Senate, which seems like a very high, nearly impossible bar. As Margaret pointed out, even if you tried to change the filibuster rules, you're still running into difficulty with these two moderate Democrats, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. The other challenge for Democrats, again, is that it's looking very likely that Republicans will be taking over the House of Representatives come November of 2022. The way things are shaping up, and given given the momentum that Republicans have heading into this economy and into the fall midterms, and so if the House flips, even if you gained a couple seats for Democrats in the United States Senate, if the House flips, then nothing's going to get past the House in terms of trying to codify Roe v. Wade or even, privacy issues that Joe Biden has been emphasizing so much. So, again, it's just a really tough landscape for Democrats in trying to do anything legislatively on the abortion front.
Let me turn to the January 6th hearings now. Former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony is still reverberating. She told the committee this week that former President Trump wanted to lead his supporters to the Capitol building that day, that he knew they were armed, and he wanted metal-detecting magnetometers taken away.
I was in the vicinity of a conversation where I overheard the president say something to the effect of, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here.
Margaret Tolov, what did you make of Hutchinson's testimony and really some efforts this week to discredit her?
It really was blockbuster testimony, and all the more breathtaking when you realize this is a woman who's 25 years old. She was like 23 or 24 when all of this was happening, and she was trying to, corral the chief of staff into making difficult decisions at the White House on a pivotal day.
Yeah.
Her testimony is important for so many reasons, but one is that it really does peel back the curtain more than any testimony so far that we've heard that has been shared with the public in the January 6th investigation, and shows a president who was dealing really with rage and fury and episodes of violent behavior. You're right, there have been questions raised about the accuracy of the third-hand description in which she describes what she was told about the former president's interactions with the Secret Service. Did he grab at the wheel? How could he have done that from his SUV in the motorcade? And did Tony Ornato really tell her what she says he told her? The efforts to discredit that so far are not under oath and on the record. And so what it has set up here is a situation where in order to truly push back against the message, there will be people inside the former White House or the Secret Service who would need to testify under oath, and not just to what they want to talk about, but to answer other questions. So it's an important week in terms of a testimony, and it also revealed just how much more isn't known about the detail of that day and the days leading up to it, what someone like former White House counsel Pat Cipollone could offer even outside of the realm of executive privilege. So I think that testimony has set up future testimony and future hearings.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, who, according to Cassidy Hutchinson, pleaded for President Trump on that day to do something about the angry mob. Scott, Cipollone has been subpoenaed by the January 6th committee. Any reasonable possibility that he would testify? Because if he corroborates Hutchinson, that would be powerful.
It certainly would be powerful. And look, there's two individuals in the White House that day who know a lot of information, firsthand information about what the former president was thinking and doing as the Capitol was under attack. That's Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, who said he's not participating with this investigation, and Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, who has, to a certain extent, participated and cooperated with the investigation. He sat down with the committee for informal sessions. That is, that they were not recorded, they were not videotaped. Now he is reevaluating, now that he has the subpoena sent this week, he is reevaluating the situation, reevaluating what he might be able to say in terms of his, resistance to testify, given what he has previously cited would be protected under executive privilege. Now, remember, executive privilege does not cover things that involve criminal activity. And so if Cipollone and his attorneys believe that there was criminal activity here committed by individuals in the White House and in that Trump orbit, he may be willing to talk about some of those details. He really is the linchpin here. And Liz Cheney, the vice chair, has pointed to Cipollone as sort of the man who could reveal it all. If you remember back in the Watergate investigation, it was the White House counsel himself, John Dean, who, volunteered a lot of information that eventually led to the resignation of President Nixon back then. And so there's a lot of similar parallels that are playing out with the January 6th investigation.
Well, speaking of Liz Cheney, briefly, Margaret, she is, of course, the vice chair of the January 6th committee, and she spoke at the Reagan Presidential Library this week, where she blasted Republican leaders for enabling, as she put it, President Trump, and she spoke directly to her fellow Republicans.
We have to choose, because Republicans cannot both be loyal to Donald Trump and loyal to the Constitution. At this moment...
So, Margaret, what is Cheney's political future? She faces four primary opponents. Some wonder if she'll run for president.
She does face a crowded and very difficult primary, is trying to encourage independents and Democrats to register as Republicans to help her emerge from that primary. If she did, it would be the political story of the year, no doubt. And it's also hard to miss some of the presidential overtures there. But I think Liz Cheney has decided a long time ago that she was not going to take the course of either supporting Trump's actions or just kind of quietly blending into the background, but she was going to put it out there and cast herself as a path back to a different kind of Republican Party. And whether that leads anywhere beyond this primary, I think is something she'll grapple with after the fact. Right now, she's running for re-election, and she's staked her bid with history.
In our last minute here, let me ask you each quickly, 20 seconds each, what else were you watching this week that went under the radar? Scott, you first.
Oh, well, I was actually in the committee hearing room for Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony, and she just did come off as very credible. I think, you know, just in the amount of details that she told about her interactions with certain people in the White House that day, a lot of people are painting her as a low-level aide, but at the same time, she was just one of a handful of people in the White House, we have to remember, on a very important day in U.S. history.
Margaret, 10 seconds.
On the January 6th hearing, I'm watching what will come in the future along the allegations of witness tampering, potential witness tampering.
All right, this is Margaret Tolliff, managing editor at Axios. Scott Wong is senior congressional reporter at NBC. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, guys.